Rob Wolf, Andy D's back with the Paleolithic Solution, episode 21. How are you?
Good, man. We are legal drinking age now.
I forgot about that.
The show is kind of like in dog years. And so by the, you know, we're going to be 70 here pretty quick and then dead. So
the dead.
People will be like, I'm totally over it. It's done. Kill it.
Although someone on the blog made a comment about they were happy that it was Sonny and Chico and the Kurt Cobain jokes were over because they were worried about the long-term health of the podcast.
Yeah, I was seriously considering the final option there for a while. So, yeah, it's a good thing.
On a movie topic, Rob, totally unrelated to what we do here on the podcast, but I rewatched The Boondock Saints this week, which is a cult classic. I don't know if you've ever actually seen that movie, Rob.
I have not taken that one in, no.
All right, I'm going to have to loan you the DVD. Anyone on the blog that has seen The Boondock Saints 2, All Saints Day, that took 15 years to make, please post your thoughts, because I'm going to go out and rent that over the next week, and I want to see. I've heard some okay things about it. Anytime it takes 15 years to make a sequel, you get a little nervous.
You know, the Chinese Democracy from Guns N' Roses is a similar example in which... high hopes, but a low follow through. So,
yeah. Although I do recall seeing Axl on a before Chinese Democracy came out, one of the MTV maybe movie awards, and it was funny to see, you know, the one skinny Axl Rose, puffy, heavy, with basically what would be almost dreads or really tightly braided cornrows, and a Oakland Raiders jersey.
Yeah, he was kind of like a redheaded Gary Busey. It was horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have, you know, we'll see. All Saints Day. I can't believe you haven't seen that movie, Rob. We're going to have to loan that to you. I don't know that Nikki is going to like it, but that's on the list of things Rob may enjoy, but Nikki will not.
We have little overlap in music and music. music and movies. So, yeah, we'll see.
Luckily, the cat, you know, ties you together.
We agree on the cat. Yeah. If we ever divorce, I don't know who will get the haunch or the top. So, see.
All right, cool. Well, another good group of questions. Actually, this week, my question of the week is going to be question one, Rob. So I'm kind of fired up about this.
Okay, no sneak attacks at the end when I think we're done. Perfect.
Yeah, no sneak attacks. So I am going to – this is multi-part. So we'll read the first question and then let you start the answer from there, and then we'll go through parts 2, 3, and 4.
Sweet.
But I feel like our friend Jay is a little spun out after reading some stuff on Stefan Lindbergh's website.
We had to ship Jay some clandestine antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds just to make sure he got through this thing, because it sounded like there needed to be an intervention here.
Yeah, the wheels have definitely come off for Jay. So, yeah. Question from Jay. Rob, I'm having a major breakdown on the nutrition front. I just finished reading Stefan Lindbergh's website, and he takes apart almost everything I thought I knew about nutrition. Here's the link, and we'll provide it in the notes. Here are my concerns. I've just included the important excerpt here, but the whole piece at the link is crucial to read. Number one, Stefan Lindbergh states, hence there is as yet no strong evidence that a low intake of fruits or vegetables is an independent cause of Western disease. I know fructose and fruit can be problematic, fine, but vegetables, I've read so many studies suggesting vegetables are crucial to health for their antioxidant,
polyphenol,
thank you, nutrient action. Most importantly, I've read many articles and a book stating vegetables are our best defense against cancer.
This one is kind of a meaty little chunk. You know, an important thing to point out is that Lindbergh is a MD, PhD. I think his background originally was in analytical chemistry, unless I'm mistaking his background with Fritz Muskite, who is another paleo researcher. If I'm getting him confused, I apologize. But Lindbergh's just a very thorough researcher. So what he's getting in and looking at here, and I think Jay has misread this, what Lindbergh is saying is that comparatively low intake of fruits and vegetables do not appear to be an independent cause of the Western diseases, and this is from some epidemiological data, some clinical data and whatnot. Obviously fruits and vegetables are healthy, but this is reminiscent of what we see in the good calories, bad calories, where a lot of what we assumed to be nutrient, you know, like recommended daily allowances and whatnot, vitamin C, B vitamins, these levels that we appear to need are very, very dependent on the macronutrients that we're taking in. So if we're taking in a lot of carbohydrate, we're going to require more B vitamins and some of these other cofactors that are involved in the processing of the carbohydrate. If we're taking in comparatively little carbohydrate, then we need relatively little. And then vegetables, as a just kind of an independent entity, end up providing significantly more nutrients than they do micronutrients than they do macronutrients. So you end up with excess, as it were, of B vitamins as compared to the amount of carbohydrate that you're taking in typically. So this is some of the stuff that's going on there. It's complex, but all that he's saying is that simply eating comparatively little fruits and vegetables is not going to give you hyperinsulinism. That's what Lindberg is saying in that statement.
And this also reminds me a little bit of my one of my favorite Kurt Harris blog posts on the Panu blog, which was titled "Plants and Plants Compounds Are Not Essential or Magic."
Right.
Which I think is also a pretty interesting read and a little bit along the same line. So I'll actually post the link to that in the show notes because I think it's worth consideration.
Yeah, totally. And it's just it's where this starts getting into, you know, it's not white hats and black hats. It's not like good and bad per se. It's, you know, what are the roles that these things play biologically more than anything else? And, you know, are they novel like grains and do they have problems associated with them then? Or is it more of an ancestral kind of diet matching? So, yeah, that the Panu stuff is awesome. And I remember that article. It's really good.
Yeah, I think you also made the interesting point there that depending on, you know, well, I guess no shocker to us, but depending on your macronutrient intakes, it's going to affect, you know, the needs of things that you take in, basically. That's said very poorly, but, you know.
Macronutrients heavily influence your need for micronutrients as cofactors in their metabolism. And that's just a thing to keep in mind or crack out at a, you know, cocktail party as a means of picking up on somebody.
That helps you pick someone up. You are at the wrong party.
Or maybe the right party.
That's
I don't know.
That's a good point.
You found the one party in all the world where you might actually be cool. So,
Awesome. All right. The second concern from Jay is that Stefan states, one of the strongest beliefs held about healthy food is that fatty fish presents heart disease and that omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids are the main reason. However, the evidence is not by far as solid as it may seem. Jay says, I don't even need to tell you how that flies in the face of everything I thought I knew.
Well, I think the point here, when you read all of Lindberg's work on this, he's just getting in and pointing out that you can get omega-3s from a variety of sources, that it's more specific to the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 in the diet than anything just inherently magical about like fatty fish. So like again, like if you pull these things out in isolation, then you can make it look really confusing or contradictory, but it's still very consistent with what we understand with all the stuff. And part of the point that can be made here, like in the Katavan diet, which is what Lindberg has spent a ton of time researching, they do not intake very much in the way of omega-3s or omega-6s because they're taking in a significantly larger amount of saturated fat in the form of coconut. But the point there is that they still have an omega-3 omega-6 ratio that's approximately like a 1-to-1 or a 1-to-2. So it seems to be still more of that ratio as the main issue that we want to keep an eye on, and not so much the amount of fatty acids that we're looking at. And then you know, like Melissa and Dallas put together that fish oil calculator, and they stuck my name on it, which was very, very kind of them to do that. And the reason why we're recommending large amounts of omega-3s for people when they're sick is because they literally have pounds and pounds of omega-6 in their body that needs to get balanced out just to kind of get the metabolism switched around. So that's a lot of why we're recommending that. It's more trying to fix a broken situation and then bring it back into norms. And if your day-to-day intake of omega-6 is relatively low, then your need for omega-3s are relatively low.
Yep. OK, Good. All right. Point three, Stefan states, although restriction of all types of carbohydrates may provide some benefit for subjects with diabetes type 2, it seems unlikely that dietary carbohydrate is a primary cause of Western disease. So Jay's take was, basically, I got low-carb diets are bull, and we're silly for believing they are good for us unless we're already diabetic.
You know, Lindbergh's thing, like, it sometimes it's like, you know, and Kurt Harris has his thing on I'm so tired of the Katavans thing and a takeoff, I think, from the Clash song. But this thing totally flies in the face of most of what we've kind of thought about hunter-gatherer diets and whatnot. Cordain has made the point that, you know, there was significant fruit and vegetables in the diet, typically from the ancestral diet, but, you know, there was a larger amount of calories coming from animal sources and whatnot. But then you have the pesky Katavans that pop in here. And what we find is that they had a very high intake of dietary carbohydrate, mainly from a yam, sweet potato, fruit kind of sources. And they had essentially no metabolic derangement. And then they started adopting a more westernized type diet with greater grain intake. So it didn't really change the amount of carbohydrates, just the types. And then these folks started developing metabolic problems, which was really, really interesting. And then Lindbergh was the primary investigator on the first human trial of a Paleolithic diet in type 2 diabetics. And he was really, really slick in how he did this, because the control group that they used was the Mediterranean grain-based, low-fat dairy comparison group. And so both of these groups are type 2 diabetics. One group is doing an unweighed, unmeasured paleo diet, meat, fruit, veggies, nuts and seeds. The other group is a unweighed, unmeasured Mediterranean diet. Both groups are eating to satiety. The Mediterranean group found no metabolic benefit. They did not improve their oral glucose tolerance tests at all, whereas at the end of the study for the paleo diet folks, they were technically not type 2 diabetic anymore. They had reestablished normal glucose tolerance tests. They had not really lost any weight, not even around the umbilical measurement, which is interesting because we put a lot of stock in that umbilical measurement as an indicator of insulin resistance. But when we start looking at leptin resistance and leptin resistance as it plays into insulin resistance, then we may have seen some of the early stages of the insulin resistance reversing, starting with the leptin resistance reversing. And so that allowing normal insulin signaling in the paleo diet folks. But what this, you know, this is a really important point, which is that, you know, I think that there are some very, very healthy reasons for eating low carb, particularly cyclically throughout the year. A lot of Volix stuff seems to support this. There's just a ton of information out there, all the information on hormesis and hysteresis, these different cellular processes of punctuated cellular stress causing an adaptation to that stress. And I think that there's a big argument for limiting carbohydrate at various points. But what this research also points out is that people can and do eat higher amounts of carbohydrates and they live just fine. But it's more often than not a non-grain-based situation. Like, we seem to see much better results with a non-grain situation. Another good example of that is the Okinawan scenario. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting piece, and in some ways you'd like it to just go away because the story would be much simpler, but life is not that that way for us. So.
And I feel like we're on the Kurt Harris fan club today, because I'm totally going to put – I totally forgot about his "I'm so bored with the Katavans" post.
That, yeah, it's awesome. A great piece.
That's awesome. So I'll put that link in for folks to read as well, because I think that it's a very interesting and well-written piece. And it's, you know, supports the Clash, so they were a good band.
I remember, though, Matt Lalonde was not a real fan of Kurt's piece there, and I forget what the points were. And so when we get Matt on here, maybe we'll just stick in our brain maybe to ask him what his beef was with that, because there were some elements of that Matt did not like, some of the I think some of the logic behind it. He was okay with the conclusion, but the way that the logic was formulated, he wasn't a fan. So it'd be interesting to get his perspective on that.
Yeah, we need to get the Matt LaLonde interview scheduled so both people can start to pose questions.
Even more people can worship all that is the LaLonde. So.
Yeah, maybe we should also say, you know, we're going to put the blog post up that we're going to have Dallas and Melissa from Hole 9 on as well.
Mm. Yeah, when we know that show date, then we'll post a blog on that so that folks can ask them questions.
And I think it highlights one bias in our approach, Rob, is that we're only going to take men that are Canadian because it cuts down how many men can be on our show since Matt and Dallas are both from Canada.
Right.
But we'll allow any women on the show.
Any women, yeah.
All right, totally off track. Number four, Stefan states the antioxidant story mainly emerged from intriguing hypothesis in molecular biology, but randomized double-blind controlled trials with antioxidants have essentially failed to show any benefit. Jay says, I honestly believed antioxidants were beneficial for stopping oxidation of fats in my diet and body so they don't wreak havoc on my body. Keeping cholesterol from oxidizing by eating vegetables seems like a good idea.
And it absolutely is. What Lindbergh is talking about is supra-physiological doses, doses way above what we would normally get from dietary sources of antioxidants. And what, you know, the theory was we can see damage accrue in both proteins and DNA that are from reactive oxygen species, from free radicals that are generated either from cooking methods or high temperatures, UV radiation, like a whole host of sources, and these reactive oxygen species, these free radicals, could then damage DNA, protein, and cause a lot of problems. And there was definitely some understanding that things like superoxide dismutase, which is our normal endogenous antioxidant hormone, like one of the most important ones, it's not a hormone, it's an enzyme, it, levels of SOD, superoxide dismutase, were very, very important in mitigating oxidative damage. And so the assumption was, well, if oxidative damage is bad, high amounts of antioxidant intake should be good. We should see decreases in various types of diseases, ranging from cancer to diabetes to heart disease. But what we found was no benefit at high dose antioxidant intake, and frequently an acceleration of the process, you know, like super high dose vitamin C actually being pro-oxidative and whatnot, because none of these things are ever purely an antioxidant. Redox reactions, oxidation reduction reactions, are there's always an uphill, there's always a downhill for the most part, and especially in biological systems, there's always something that could oxidize a reduced agent, there's always something that can reduce an oxidized agent. If that's all a bunch of hookadook for the people who don't have a chemistry background, I apologize. But it basically just means that there's not a 100% answer as to whether or not something is an antioxidant or a pro-oxidant. It's all relative to who else is in the neighborhood, basically. And that has really big bearing on whether or not an organic system is going to be in a pro-oxidative state or an antioxidative state. And what we find is that the consumption of antioxidants from fruits, vegetables, even some of the meat, and grass-fed meat in particular, gets full of various types of carotenoids and antioxidant compounds from the vegetable matter. That is a great way to puff up the antioxidant content of an organism, because it's a variety of antioxidants and not just one flavor of antioxidant, which is what has historically been studied in these antioxidant trials. So that's why still eating a nice varied diet is important for these antioxidant qualities.
And Jay, I think we've already concluded, but Jay finishes his question by saying, I just don't know what to do anymore. What the hell am I supposed to eat? What's good for me? It's not grains, dairy, legumes, or vegetable oils. In most cases, it's also not nuts, fruit, or eggs. And I've been told it's not vegetables or fish oil either. Oh, and carbs don't matter anymore. Eat as many as I want. However, they can only be tubers. Do I just eat meat and tubers? Sorry for the long post, but I'm falling apart.
It's horrible to laugh at somebody losing their mind, but yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, eat meat, fruit, veggies, have some tubers. If you feel like the tubers don't work for you, then stick with the meat and veggies. I wrote a quick answer to Jay, and it's still basically like nothing has changed here, only our understanding has deepened a little bit, but the clinical implementation, nothing has really changed with this.
The sky has not fallen.
Not yet. But really good question. I mean, it's an outstanding question, and it's the amount of information that we have readily available these days is just staggering. I was emailing Matt Lalonde about something. I forget even what it was. And then he pointed out, I think I said something about you don't see much insulin resistance in the Maasai, talking about their mm-hmm. intake of dairy. We're trying to figure out how or if dairy would cause some insulin resistance related to leptin resistance and all this. And I said, well, you don't see much insulin resistance in the Maasai. And then he said, yeah, but the cattle that the Maasai use are considered an A1 type of cattle, or an A2, I forget. There's an A1 and an A2. One of those varieties, the variety that the Maasai use, which is an older variety of cattle, the type of casein that it makes is less insulin spiking and just generally less problematic. And so that's possibly part of the situation they have going on. But I was like, where the hell did you find that? And he was doing some research on casein. And so it's just this thing where if you're not on all the time, just constantly poking around on the research, you just get buried, or you decide to find one area of expertise and call it good. But when you're trying to keep as much of an eye on strength and conditioning and Paleolithic nutrition, which is this just gargantuan field all the way around, it's a lot to stay on top of.
Yeah, and right.
The questions that people ask continue to get more and more complex. At some point, the questioners are going to have to be the answers, because I'm not going to know what the hell I'm talking about at some point. So,
yeah, and seriously, Jay, right on for asking an awesome question. I saw this and I was like, this is a good question. Dig Lindbergh's stuff, it's good. Just needs to be taken in context of kind of the bigger picture.
Totally.
Cool. All right. Next, we got a question for Barry from Barry. It says, hello, Rob and Andy. Thanks to iTunes. I think I'm now caught up on all the podcast episodes and always look forward to the next one. Hope the weather is looking better in Chico, since all those Cobain jokes are getting me worried about the future of the podcast.
We're good. We're on the other side now. We're good.
We are okay. And thank you, Barry, for making it through all those episodes when the sound quality is way worse than it is now. I get scared every time my iPod on shuffle hits episode 2, and I'm like, wow, this sounds bad. I don't know why anyone actually listened to this.
I'm still not sure that anybody does. I think people are pulling my leg, but we'll run with it anyway.
That's right. We have one or two people that actually listen to it. So anyway, two questions for us, both of which you may want to save for the supplementation podcast. Heck no, we're going to throw them in today.
Sure.
Because anything related to CrossFit Journal, Rob Wolf will get spun up about.
And Andy Dees is all about creating a spun up Rob Wolf. So
that's right. Turkish get ups.
Anything I could do. Turkish get ups in my gym the other night while I wasn't there. Bastard.
Anything to spin up Rob is well worth the effort. So, question one, would you be willing to comment on the recent piece in the CrossFit Journal by Chris Mason on post-workout nutrition? And the title was Optimized Post-Workout Nutrition for the CrossFit Athlete. Leaving aside the conflict of interest inherent in the article, he recommends a whey casein blend shake as the ideal post-workout meal, which is conveniently a product that his company manufactures and sells. I wanted to hear your take on two issues he raises in the article. First, the issue of preferring liquid over solid food for immediate post-workout nutrition. Mason argues that the faster you can make amino acids and glucose available to the muscle cells, the greater the potential workout recovery response, and that since liquid meals are normally digested and absorbed at a slightly quicker pace than a comparable solid mood field, falling apart here.
We need to quit drinking before this thing.
I know, man. I'm well within my coffee dose today. Solid food meal, and that the post-workout shake is a superior choice. So let's start with that.
The podcast died on episode 21. We're done, folks. We're out.
Andy can no longer read simple English. Okay, anyway.
The question here, the assertion is that liquid food is good because it causes an insulin spike, and insulin spikes post-workout are good because it enhances recovery. And these suppositions are very, very subjective. In some situations, liquid food is of benefit. In some situations, post-workout insulin spike is of benefit. But it is by no means the across-the-board answer, as we have seen again and again and again. And I wish that this was just the simple one-stop shop. It's like high carbohydrate post-workout meal, done. but it's just not the case. Anybody with an inflammation issue, they would be better off not spiking insulin post-workout. Anybody still trying to lean out, they would be better off not spiking insulin post-workout. Anybody generally who's trying to lose body fat would be good not to spike insulin and would be well served not to take in any dairy because of the inherent insulin spiking characteristics of the dairy. So it's just very, you know, and again, you see this pretty across the board. And I don't want to hang myself here by saying, you know, if you start recommending, if you have a food interest, then you're going to start recommending a specific food, because obviously I've got an interest in paleo brands, but I've been recommending like whole food since the beginning of all this. And this is largely the reason why I haven't been able to really get all that solidly behind post-workout liquid type things like the shakes, because I see them hamstring and hurt as many people as help. And particularly when people are always looking for a shortcut, and when you're just looking to sell people product, then it gets really easy to slide down that slippery slope and be like, ah, it won't make you fat, it's fine, you know. And so there's just a bunch of stuff with that. Like a post-workout carbohydrate, post-workout insulin spiking is not always the most important thing to do. There's a lot of other ways to tackle it. We've talked about that in a you know, I think podcast one. I've got several written blog posts on post-workout nutrition. There's a lot of nuances to it. The other thing that is really, really interesting to me in this whole scenario, let's say that, yeah, okay, post-workout nutrition is the cat's meow. It is absolutely the way that you want to go. He recommends a post-workout casein and whey protein shake. What's in whole milk? Casein and whey protein. What's in whole chocolate milk? Casein and whey protein with extra carbohydrate. It's not maltodextrin, so you do have some of that nutrient partitioning issue. But there's some very well-done literature that compares all of these different kind of jiggy post-workout shakes with simply milk or chocolate milk. And the milk and chocolate milk consistently outperform the shakes.
Yeah, and this is the one, I think, for us, we're like, dial in your nutrition, whole foods, get all that stuff figured out, probably get as lean as you want, and then you can start playing with this stuff and actually have a reasonable idea how it is affecting you positively or negatively.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So if you want to play with this stuff, you know, again, just to recap, but this is all back in episode one and the other post-workout things. If you're a lean, pipe-hitting, like, stud athlete, whether male or female, and you want to tinker with some ways of improving your recovery, by all means, check out some sort of liquid nutrition. But if you think something is inherently better in a shake than it is just from like standard milk, in my opinion, that's absolutely false.
Yep. All right, good. Question two, T-Nation is currently making a big deal about the BioTest Flameout Omega-3 supplement. Their big claim is that the EPA and DHA levels are more balanced for men's metabolism, sort of like secret deodorant in reverse, which is an awesome
analogy. Yeah,
it's just so good. Is there anything to this claim that men need more DHA than women?
Unless there's something that I am completely unaware of, I can find no recommendation for that. There's been some talk about should folks generally have more DHA than EPA because of like some anti-inflammatory issues and whatnot. I think Garrett Smith makes a point that he's mainly shifting towards just doing an algae-based DHA supplement because you can get a back conversion of DHA into EPA on an as-needed basis, and that seems fine to me. Like I see no problem with that. But the reality is that women, I could almost make an argument, would need more DHA because if they are of pregnant, lactating, any type of scenario like that, their DHA demands are going to be much greater than a male's demands. So unless there's some nuance of like testosterone metabolism or something like that that's very, very DHA dependent that I'm unaware of, I would say a woman's need for DHA is higher than a man's. And particularly if we were to extrapolate this over a lifetime, for sure a woman's need for DHA is going to be heavier. Childbearing, breastfeeding, all that sort of stuff. So I'll do a little poking around on this, but I did some initial research and I just couldn't figure out where they were coming from on this. So I would say bunk on that one. Busted. Is that the thing on Mythbusters? Busted. I don't like it. Yeah.
All right. Secret deodorant in reverse. That is genius. I never considered that, but that's so funny. All right, moving on. Question three from, I'm going to go with Mostyn.
Mostyn, yeah.
Okay. What's your opinion on raw food? As to my knowledge, our ancestors lived primarily on raw foods, and whether cooked foods are harmful to our body. What's your opinion?
It's pretty clear that, you know, a big change in our metabolism happened when we started actually eating more cooked food. Like, there was actually a decrease in the size of the gut, decrease in the dentition, like how robust our teeth are. And that's been a key part of our development. There's also no doubt that we've had a significant amount of raw food in the diet too. And the simple answer here is we're wired up pretty nicely for a mix. And I just kind of wrap that into like some seasonal eating. You know, it's really not that complex. And I don't see the raw food people, it's kind of funny because when you make the point that food is more easily digested, they always make the argument that if you cook food, it inactivates the enzymes that break down the food. But even though there are autolytic enzymes in various foods, you know, like in grains and in meat and all that sort of stuff, enzymes that are inside the organism itself that ends up breaking part of the organism down when we eat it, our digestive enzymes are far more powerful with regards to that ultimate kind of digestive process. So these things are really not that big a factor. And then when you point out the fact that the glycemic index or the ability to digest foods are dramatically enhanced with cooking, because the fundamental part of cooking, like you crystallize starch granules, which make them more available for amylase to work on them. We end up breaking down the quaternary and tertiary structure of proteins, and so make them more available for the pepsins and various proteolytic enzymes to break down the proteins. It is obvious that cooking makes it easier to break stuff down. We get higher blood glucose concentrations on the same foods, whether it's cooked versus raw. So it's obviously easier to break this stuff down. Are certain nutrients destroyed in the cooking process? Yes. There are other nutrients that are only absorbed when we cook them. Like a lot of the carotenoids are dramatically enhanced when we cook them and when we consume the carotenoids with fat. So again, like, there's not a perfect easy answer to that.
Yeah, and I think a book for consideration would be Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Richard Wrangham, maybe, is his name. He's like a biological anthropologist. And I think he argues that, you know, we have evidence of up to, like, almost 2 million years ago.
2 million years, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, so, anyway. Raw food. No, no comment.
Sushi's good. Ceviche is good.
Oh, for sure, yeah. But. Yeah. I wouldn't eat that for every meal. I guess, no. Well, maybe I would, but
yeah.
Moving on. Good question. Question from Lauren. Hi, Rob and Andy. I really enjoyed the podcast. I noticed Trader Joe's is selling a resveratrol supplement. It's a little pricey for my budget, but is this something worth taking? My goals are to lean out a bit, get stronger. I already eat paleo, CrossFit 4 to 5 days a week, and sleep 8 hours a night, etc.
Dude, you're sneaking in all these
I know.
Questions, you bastard.
It's part of my spin Rob out day.
You know, the resveratrol is super cool stuff. The studies are really interesting. The problem is the absorption on it is terrible. There are some lyophilized products where they bind it to a phospholipid carrier, and it seems to enhance the absorption. If you've got the cash and you want to throw down for it, take it with a fatty meal. I mean, it's really good, interesting stuff. It's still just inconclusive whether or not supplemental levels of resveratrol do much of anything. I think that the main studies that they showed, like, some really enhanced uptake was actually like an injectable form of it, and that seems like kind of a bugger to me. So it's tough to super duper endorse it because it's tough to absorb, but it is good. Resveratrol is super cool. You know, interesting anti-aging properties, preventing cellular senescence and all that. It's cool stuff.
So, Rob, actually, the reason I put this question in, because I like part two.
Part two, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Which is back to our artificial sweetener problem. So, second question. I tend to chew a lot of gum and drink diet root beer 2 times a day. I also enjoy a diet peach Snapple every once in a while. In your experience as a coach trainer, have a lot of artificial sweeteners significantly halted weight loss? Can you recommend a replacement?
As to whether or not it halts weight loss, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where when we're trying to lean somebody out, if they are stalling, this is just like that inevitable thing. It's kind of funny. Like some people who are naturally lean, like there are some people who are just lean no matter what. Like they do whatever they want and they're kind of lean and we all hate them. And then there are other people who are pretty lean, pretty muscular, and they just have migrated towards all the right stuff. And then there are other folks that are on the other side of the spectrum where in quotations, always had weight problems. But then when you look at what they're up to, the sleep is bad. They've got a ton of artificial sweeteners. They're still eating, pretty processed foods and all that. And this is just one of those weird things that people are trying to lean out and they get stalled. Like, how's your sleep? How much dairy is making up your protein sources? Are you doing artificial sweeteners? You know, and what's your kind of basal stress level? And those things can bugger fat loss. We understand pretty well. There was just a recent study that and I've made this point, the whole like food porn, you know, just simply looking at food for some people can release insulin. They just had a study where folks were told to simply anticipate a meal and they started releasing insulin. So bottom line is if you're trying to lean out and you're doing artificial sweeteners, you're probably shooting yourself in the foot. If you're already lean and you don't feel like the artificial sweeteners are causing you a problem, God love you, go for it, do whatever you want to do.
And I think it's just funny like how addictive some of this stuff is. Like, mm-hmm. I have a client that I train every once in a while, and she's been off like diet soda for maybe almost 3 months now. And she, like, it's literally like alcohol for her. Like, you talk to her and she's like, Andy, I will still sit around the office and think about my Diet Cokes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the fact that someone even asked this question, like, I'm like, you know, take it out and see what happens. Like, what's 30 days?
Yeah, or can you take it out?
Yeah, can you actually survive without your two diet root beers? I mean, shoot, I'd love to drink some root beer too sometimes, but it's not going to help.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, good. Next, we got a question from Matt. He says, hi, guys. Love your stuff and love the paleo CrossFit lifestyle. There's a problem, though. One, my sleep has gone into the, I'm not going to say this word because we're trying to tone down our swearing. So his sleep's gotten bad for sure.
It's gone on the skids.
Yes, thank you, Rob. It's on the skids. I'm sure that it's not overtraining since I'm not at the WOD stage and I'm doing basic stuff, two on, one off for no more than 30 minutes at a pop. I can fall asleep no problem. I have turned into a very light sleeper and wake up constantly at night. Part two of this is also the problem. Since I went paleo about 3 months ago, I developed nighttime lower leg cramps. Stretching before bed helps. Also started taking vitamin E at night in addition to magnesium and zinc during the day, all with as much water as I can remember to drink. Thanks all. That's all for now. Keep up the good work, and thanks.
You know, when saying basic stuff, the two on, one off, I'm guessing that means strength work, but I don't know for sure. If it still means like Metcon type stuff that are no more than 30 minutes a pop, then that may be the problem right there. So I do, for Matt, some clarification, like what is it that you're doing? Folks still just don't get that the you know, these long 30-minute Metcons and stuff like that, like, you're really doing counterproductive work doing much of those. The classic, like, singlets, couplets, triplets of CrossFit yesteryear, that's where the money is, and that's where the power is, that's where the adaptation lies, that's where the bulk of your programming should lie if you're trying to get ready for the CrossFit Games or even just generally be fit and healthy. So I'm unsure what exactly he means by the two-on-one off and less than 30 minutes a pop. If it's just strength work, then that's probably not the problem. If it's Metcons for 30 minutes, then that absolutely could be the problem. With the leg cramps and all that, I mean, he may just need some more fruits and vegetables thrown in the mix, a little bit of the natural calm, you know, some magnesium supplementation. Without seeing exactly what he's taking in, it might be a little bit hard to figure out where the electrolyte level is on all this. And there again, we still don't know for sure what he's doing with his legitimate level of activity. Like, he may be actually doing a ton of work and the leg cramps are actually completely reasonable. But, you know, trying the more fruits and vegetables, some natural calm, and maybe get back to us on what the actual workout schedule is.
Yeah, and I feel like the Natural Calm, you know, the magnesium before bed seems to make a big difference for folks as opposed to taking it during the day. Like, I'd be curious, he's like, addition to magnesium and zinc, I don't know if that's a ZMA thing, if he's taking them separate, but I mean, we like Natural Calm because it seems to work really well for a lot of people and puts us to sleep.
Yeah, yeah, and just magically so, very, very powerfully.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, I don't, the two-on, one-off, 30 minutes of pop, I mean, I don't know if people are looking at like the dot-com wads or whatever, but you know, we have folks in our gym where even 30 minutes of effort when they start is pretty significant. You know, I think it's all relative to where you are. If you're a 21-year-old, you know, college stud, well, you know, your tolerance is going to be a little different than if you're 45 years old and haven't worked out in 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, the poison's always in the dose.
Yep, yep. Well, that's a Glassmanism. Stop saying that, Rob.
No, I did that, that's mine. That's mine.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. His is the dose response curve, which is stolen from somewhere else. All right, Rob. You're close there, brother.
You're like, just provoking me today.
I know. I've had a lot of coffee. Well, I had it later in the day, I guess. My 6 a.m. client canceled, so I slept in a bit today, so that was nice.
It was actually perkier today.
Yeah, exactly. Perkier. Okay. Good squat session. I feel good. Question 6 from Derek, but this is a different Derek. Not our good friend Derek.
The 10,000 question Derek. Who we love.
Who we love, exactly. Rob, I belong to CrossFit Bernardsville. I have no idea where that is. Should probably look it up. And a decent CrossFitter. With my coach's help, I set up a paleo diet plan with no fruit to help me lean down even further. I've seen dramatic improvements in my physique, but experienced an interesting issue. The second week on paleo, I felt like lactic acid was building up more quickly on my legs, and I would burn out faster than pre-paleo. Does this seem normal from what you have seen?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you switch up the fueling, cut the carbohydrates down. That's totally typical. I have that blog post, The Zone and Athletic Performance, and it talks about the transition from a carbohydrate-based metabolism into a more ketogenic-type metabolism. I draw really heavily off of the nutrition and metabolism piece, looking at ketogenic diets and athletic performance. But what Derek's, you know, this is the thing. Derek's wanting to lean out, so you may end up taking a hit on the performance side to be able to lean out. Now, there might also be ways of leaning out and augmenting performance, or, you know, at least supporting performance at the same time. But folks are so focused in trying to make everything go up all at once. And I think that there's also this sense, particularly when people first get going in CrossFit or they just get going in training in general, everything does improve at once. It's called the novice effect, and gains are cheap and easy. And then as you get further down the road, you need to really think about what the heck you're doing if you want to change any part of your game, if you want to gain muscle, lose body fat, improve your 800-meter run time. Like at some point when you've gone beyond simply being a beginner, then you need to actually put some planning into this stuff. So, yeah, this is totally normal, and this is just kind of a indicative of you want to lean out, so you're going to probably take a hit on your performance for a while. Then when you get to your level of leanness, then you're probably going to titrate your carbs back up to a point where you see some really optimized performance. But it's that, you know, monkey hand in the jar analogy again. It's like you've got to be willing to let some stuff down to be able to make some progress in other areas.
Yeah, and you also have to be willing to, I think, go through an adaptation period, which most folks seem to
get. So for Derek, we don't know if he's simply adapting to a lower carbohydrate level, and similar to a lot of folks, this may actually be where he runs best, or we may be seeing him, you know, operating behind the curve, but he's decreasing the carbohydrate so that we're controlling insulin and we're getting a leaning out effect. And then he'll end up dialing the carbohydrate up for better performance down the road. It's too early to tell exactly where he's at on that, though.
Yep. All right. Good. Next, we had a question from Anu. Hi, Rob. What's your opinion of children going on the low-carb paleo diet? Is it bad for children to be in ketosis? Any health detriments to children adopting a paleo diet? And if they do eat dairy, do you recommend whole milk or 2%? We're debating whether to introduce the girls to paleo with daily dairy that I follow. I wanted to make sure that it's okay to do so.
I obviously,
you're the new Dr. Spock.
Jeez, Louise. The kid thing always weirds me out because I know somebody's going to come and shoot me and be like, you told me to raise my kids wrong. And, you know, just, oh, God, I almost don't want to answer kid questions anymore. But, you know, kids are just little people. I mean, once you get past like being an infant, infants don't metabolize EPA properly, and they're still supposed to be breastfed. So to a degree, like, you kind of get that whole thing gets fixed. Like, breastfed your kids as long as you can, and they tend to do good, and the mom does well. There's health benefits for both those. And then beyond that, they're small human beings, and so you feed them the way that large human beings eat, only smaller portions, and they're going to like some things and not like other things. And generally, if they are given good options, meat, fruit, veggies, chicken, you know, all that sort of stuff, they find the stuff that they like, and very, very hard to induce some sort of a nutrient deficiency in them. It's interesting, though, where Anu was asking about the ketosis. I mean, a paleo diet doesn't mean that it's ketogenic. So it's really important to kind of understand what these distinctions are. Ketogenic is very, very low carbohydrate, moderate protein, higher fat. Interestingly, on that front, ketogenic diets have been studied for over 80 years in children with epilepsy, and it's still to date the most effective treatment for epilepsy known. It's far more effective than the drugs that are given for epilepsy, and with fewer side effects. So, you know, on the simply ketogenic diet question, yes, they're safe for kids. They're used clinically a ton for different epileptic type seizures. And then a paleo diet need not be ketogenic. It can be plenty of fruits and vegetables. And then on the whole dairy gig, like, if you think that the kids are missing something because they don't have dairy, in my opinion, that is completely false. They're not missing anything out of the dairy, and they may actually be doing much better without it. We can do a whole dairy broadcast at some point, but just the short of it is that they're not missing anything out of the dairy. If there's a perception that they're missing calcium or something like that, that is just absolutely false.
And I think every time we do this, we mention it again, Everyday Paleo from Sarah Fragoso, who works with us at the gym, who has her whole little band of children and her beast of a husband eating paleo. And I think it's cool to see how the kids eat. And I think it's a cool implementation. She doesn't make them crazy, and they do great. They're studs.
Yeah. The whole family is super healthy and does great on this. Three kids, two chihuahuas, and a spastic husband. So, yeah.
So we'll put the link in, although I think it's already on the blog roll, but I'll throw it in the show notes. So.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Next, we got a question from Zach. Hi, Rob. I'm a trainer at BTB Fitness in Atlanta, and I attended your nutrition cert a few months back. Oh, was that a cert or a seminar, Rob? I'm always confused.
Oh, man, they're all certs.
I've been doing paleo for about 4 to 5 months, and I've been seeing amazing results. However, my girlfriend is complaining about really bad breath. She says it smells like Chinese herbs and permeates the entire room. With your standard bad breath, I usually know when I have it. However, this, I'm completely unaware. I read that if you eat too many nuts, your body doesn't digest them and they rot in your stomach, so I admitted nuts for a few days and it didn't help. I also think it could be red wine, though doubtful because I don't drink that much, or maybe coffee. I think it's definitely a stomach thing, and I'm aware of some stomach grumbles when she complains about the bad breath. I've considered adding some yogurt to my diet, but I really don't want to stray from paleo. If you give me any info, I would be extremely grateful, and I'm sure my girlfriend and CrossFit clients would be too. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Wow. you got to have some pretty good breath going if the clients and the girlfriend are complaining about it. So we better figure this one out like ASAP. You definitely can get some different breath from different type of gut flora. And, you know, that can change based on the amounts of, like, protein, carbohydrate, and fat that you're taking in. A more meat-oriented diet, like what I tend to eat, you get a different type of bacteria than you do a more, like, kind of fruit, yam, sweet potato kind of diet. Although I do not appear to have any problems with bad breath, but I also take probiotics pretty frequently. So like he definitely, I mean, the yogurt isn't that big a deal. If you don't want to use the yogurt, you could do raw sauerkraut, just a simple probiotic. New Chapter and Jaro both have really good probiotic formulas. I recommend, if you do probiotics, to use different companies, like rotate through them, because each one uses different strains, and so it's important to have as much diversity in the gut flora as you can. That would probably help. And then another wacky thing that you might try is a tongue scraper. A lot of people, when they're doing their whole oral hygiene thing, like they'll brush, they'll floss, but the tongue scraper actually ends up removing a bacterial film that burrows into the taste buds of your tongue and can actually be a pretty gnarly source of bacteria and fun. So the tongue scraper might be an idea too. And you can just use a spoon for that, but that might be something to throw in the mix once or twice a day and see if it helps.
I can just see this guy's poor girlfriend seeing him in the bathroom scraping his tongue with a spoon. Maybe he should look into a legitimate tongue scraper, Rob.
Hey, if it works, you know, then pull out all the stops. So,
yeah. All right. Next, we got a question from Bill. Quick question about maximizing effectiveness of carb intake on cortisol levels. In a nutshell, if carb intake is restricted sufficiently to require more or less continuous gluconeogenesis to maintain blood sugar, and cortisol is the pathway by which gluconeogenesis is activated, wouldn't eating close to zero carbs result in continuously elevated cortisol levels?
Cortisol is not the only way to turn on gluconeogenesis. It is one way to do it, but it's not the only way to do it. But the thought here is good, and this is part of the reason why the intermittent fasting stuff is really interesting, but also potentially very, very problematic, because if you are in a fasted state and then begin training, particularly at a high intensity level, then the likelihood of you releasing cortisol to prop up blood sugar levels is very, very, very high. So when I was talking with Lon Kilgore the other day and talking...
Rob...
how you can get into overtraining scenarios. You said Rob.
Okay, so something happened with the internet connection, so we lost you with... I was talking with Lon Kilgore the other day.
Oh, okay. Am I back?
You're back. You're solid now. It was a brief blip in the wild west of the internet. Maybe not. Hold on.
Dude, then you were gone for like 20 seconds.
All right, Rob, I am here. Maybe.
I'm here too.
All right, hold on. Let's tell me a story about
a man named Ed, poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed.
You know, I'm gonna shut down a bunch of stuff. This, Rob, is why I don't even know if this is recording. Kelly Starrett says coaching and podcasts are like performance art, because we never know what's gonna happen. So
we never
gonna,
do.
We're gonna close down a bunch of stuff. My iMac is a little cranky right now. And I think we're recording. So you were talking to Lon Kilgore about overtraining.
Cortisol levels that can be elevated from overtraining. And one of the obvious places that this can happen, like if we're doing intense mixed modal activity where we're using a lot of muscle mass intensely, like basically taking things down to failure, we're causing a huge stimulus to uptake glucose into the muscles. If we clear all the blood glucose out of the bloodstream into the muscles, we're going to really perturb the system. And if we do not have an easy way of replenishing that glucose, then we're going to stimulate the release of cortisol and adrenaline to release glucose out of the liver. And so this is one of those things that when I'm looking back at my own problems with elevated cortisol levels, the AM training in a fasted state, when I'm looking back at it and I was already stressed, already having problems, already overly caffeinated, and then throwing kind of fasted training on top of that, it's like, oh, I was an idiot. No wonder I ended up producing the problems that I had. But it, you know, if you're not massively stressed and if the type of activity that you're doing is not always, you know, super high intensity mixed modal type stuff, if it's more just kind of like strength training or kind of aerobic type stuff, it's probably okay. You can actually get a pretty good benefit out of training fasted and kind of flying under the radar of that cortisol issue.
Yep. And then part two of Bill's question says, likewise, to maximize development of muscle occurring in a reduced cortisol environment, wouldn't the ideal, though perhaps unattainable, unattainable diet be the one that provided just enough carbs to nearly eliminate gluconeogenesis, thus generating the lowest levels of cortisol due to diet, all other factors being equal? Or is my understanding of this simply immature?
I think that's pretty spot on from the, you know, the reality for maximum muscle development, although I'm by no means a exemplary expert in this area, but the things that seem to go into it are insulin sensitivity, but then also getting away with as much carbohydrate as you can. Definitely has some growth promotion to it, but different people have different levels of buy-in on how much carbohydrate they can tolerate in this whole scene. The cortisol management piece is definitely really important from an androgen perspective also. If your cortisol is going up, testosterone is going to go down, and it's going to have some other collateral damage effects, including insulin sensitivity because of the elevated cortisol. So there's a lot of reasons for keeping cortisol in tight check.
Yep. And with that, Rob, that ends the questions of the week. I'm going to insert the crazy planche push-ups video that Ido posted on the Gymnastics Body website,
because awesome.
It was insane. And anything that makes Ido jealous means it is nowhere near attainable for 99.9% of the rest of the population.
Exactly. But it is nice to see that Ido squirms once in a while about something.
He is not perfect. There are some things he does not feel like he will be able to obtain, which makes me smile.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, that's it. Episode 21. We're coming in just under an hour, so I think that's pretty solid.
Awesome.
Thanks, Rob. I will talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Andy. See you soon.
All right. See you.